Welcome to the Darrell McClain Show. I'm your host, Darrell McClain, and let's get into our episode.
Simply search for the T-Bone and Chick Brew podcast, available wherever fine podcasts are sold.
The Darrell McClain Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. You can get a membership for as little as $3 a month at www.patreon.com/TheDarrellMcClain Show.
We talk about a lot of serious topics on this show. One very serious topic is women's health. One company that stood out to me was VSlay.com because the owner is very transparent about her own struggles in the women's health department and has great customer service, great deals, and frequent sales. You can check her out, her great customer service, products about women's health, and frequent sales at www.VSlay.com. That is www.VSlay.com.
Justice is what love looks like in public, just as tenderness is what love looks like in private. Our quote today comes from Dr. Cornel West. Welcome to the Darrell McClain Show. Let's get into our episode.
I didn't expect to wake up yesterday to the news that the senator from the 22nd district had overnight accused me by name of grooming and sexualizing children in an email fundraising for herself. So I sat on it for a while, wondering why me. And then I realized, because I am the biggest threat to your hollow, hateful scheme. Because you can't claim that you are targeting marginalized kids in the name of, quote, parental rights if another parent is standing up to say no. So then what? Then you dehumanize and marginalize me. You say that I'm one of them. You say she's a groomer. She supports pedophilia. She wants children to believe that they were responsible for slavery and to feel bad about themselves because they're white. Well, here's a little bit of background about who I really am. Growing up, my family was very active in our church. I sang in the choir. My mom taught CCD. One day, our priest called a meeting with my mom and told her that she was not living up to the church's expectations and that she was disappointing. My mom asked why. Among other reasons, she was told it was because she was divorced and because the priest didn't see her at Mass every Sunday. So where was my mom on Sundays? She was at the soup kitchen with me. My mom taught me at a very young age that Christianity and faith was about being part of a community, about recognizing our privilege and blessings and doing what we can to be of service to others, especially people who are marginalized, targeted, and who had less. Often unfairly. I learned that service was far more important than performative nonsense like being seen in the same pew every Sunday or writing Christian in your Twitter bio and using that as a shield to target and marginalize already marginalized people. I also stand on the shoulders of people like Father Ted Hesburgh, the longtime president of the University of Notre Dame, who was active in the civil rights movement, who recognized his power and privilege as a white man, a faith leader, and the head of an influential and well-respected institution, and who saw black people in this country being targeted and discriminated against and beaten, and reached out to lock arms with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. when he was alive, when it was unpopular and risky, and marching alongside them to say, "We've got you," to offer protection and service and allyship to try to right the wrongs and fix injustice in the world. So who am I? I am a straight, white, Christian, married, suburban mom who knows that the very notion that learning about slavery or redlining or systemic racism somehow means that children are being taught to feel bad or hate themselves because they are white is absolute nonsense. No child alive today is responsible for slavery. No one in this room is responsible for slavery. But each and every single one of us bears responsibility for writing the next chapter of history. Each and every single one of us decides what happens next and how we respond to history and the world around us. We are not responsible for the past. We also cannot change the past. We can't pretend that it didn't happen or deny people their very right to exist. I am a straight, white, Christian, married, suburban mom. I want my daughter to know that she is loved, supported, and seen for whoever she becomes. I want her to be curious, empathetic, and kind. People who are different are not the reason that our roads are in bad shape after decades of disinvestment, or that healthcare costs are too high, or that teachers are leaving the profession. I want every child in this state to feel seen, heard, and supported, not marginalized and targeted because they are not straight, white, and Christian. We cannot let hateful people tell you otherwise to scapegoat and deflect from the fact that they are not doing anything to fix the real issues that impact people's lives. And I know that hate will only win if people like me stand by and let it happen. So I want to be very clear right now. Call me whatever you want. I hope you brought in a few dollars. I hope it made you sleep good last night. I know who I am. I know what faith and service means and what it calls for in this moment. We will not let hate win.
Her name is Mallory McMorrow. She's a Democrat representing Michigan's 13th district in the state Senate, and you should remember her name, because if there is anyone whose voice we should be elevating, it is people like her. This all started because Republican state senator Lana Tice decided to do what she saw her puppet masters do and accuse her Democratic state Senate colleagues of what else but being groomers. In a fundraising email, she wrote, "Last Thursday, I opened the state Senate with an invocation praying for our children's safety. Our children are under assault in our schools for gender-bending indoctrination, exposure to inappropriate sexual content, and race-based education, critical race theory, pitting children against each other. These are the people we are up against, progressive social media trolls like Senator Mallory McMorrow, who are outraged they can't teach, can't groom and sexualize kindergartners, or that eight-year-olds are responsible for slavery." That's what she wrote. She called out her Democratic colleague by name and accused her of seeking to groom and sexualize kindergartners. Now, just so that there's no confusion here, a groomer is someone who creates a connection with a child in order to eventually sexually abuse that child. That's what she was accusing McMorrow of doing. And why? Because last week, when Republican Lana Tice made an invocation on the state Senate floor, during which she justified the Republican Party's efforts to block teaching about LGBT issues and the U.S.'s history of racism, McMorrow and a couple of other Democratic colleagues walked out. And so clearly, Tice decided that means that McMorrow supports pedophilia. These Republicans are honestly just parodies of themselves. So I'll just say this once. Supporting LGBT Americans does not mean you are supportive of or enabling or are a pedophile. Being gay or being pro-LGBT has quite literally zero connection with being a groomer. And if you are accusing members of the LGBT community of being pedophiles, the only convincing argument that you're making is that you are a desperate bigot who needs a culture war issue to distract from your own party's inability to stand for anything. And so you sacrifice the most vulnerable among us for your own personal gain. Attacking LGBT Americans doesn't make you a hero, it makes you an asshole. Also, acknowledging that the U.S. has a sordid history when it comes to racism doesn't mean that we're pitting kids against each other or teaching them that they somehow own the atrocities that were committed in the past because of the color of their skin. What it teaches them is history, and how that history informs our present, and how we can grow from our past experiences to live in a better country today. No one with half a brain actually believes that teaching kids about our past means that we're blaming them for it. No more than teaching kids with German roots means that they're responsible for the Holocaust. In reality, the only reason that someone would want to stop teaching about the history of race in the U.S. is because they're too afraid that the next generation might not share their disdain for the same race-baiting tactics that they rely rely on. Because God forbid our kids learn that racism is bad and that we shouldn't make the same mistakes in the past. God forbid they don't turn out like the Laura Tices of the world. The simple fact is that Republicans don't stand for anything. They don't have a platform. They don't have solutions. And to distract you from the fact that they want taxpayer-funded salaries for doing nothing, they will look for the most emotionally graphic stories they can cook up, which is why they're trying to convince you that innocent people are grooming children. So the next time you hear a Republican like Lana Tice pretend that Democrats are pedophiles because they support LGBT Americans, or they think that we shouldn't be afraid of teaching history, try asking what she's done to actually help her constituents, other than showing the country what a vile bigot their state senator is.
Michigan State Senator Mallory McMorrow responding to a smear by a Republican colleague in a wild fundraising email. Senator McMorrow was accused of being, quote, outraged that she can't groom and sexualize kindergartners or teach that eight-year-olds are responsible for slavery. And the Michigan State Senator McMorrow joins us now. It's great to have you.
Senator, thanks so much for being
Good
with
morning.
Us. You know, I've had Democrats ask me for years as a former Republican, what do we do when they say these outrageous things to us? They're just lies. There's no way to respond because the lies are so outrageous. I heard a lot of Democrats last night saying, well, the senator just showed us how to respond. Talk about that moment, leading up to that moment, and whether you had second thoughts before getting before that microphone.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It goes without saying that this show does not happen without listener support. Support the Darrell McClain Show by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for $3. Or you can go to buzzsprouts.com/the Darrell McClain Show and hit the subscribe button and join there. Many ways to donate to the show. Independent media that won't reinforce tribalism. We have one planet. Nobody is leaving, so let us reason together. www.patreon.com/the Darrell McClain Show or go to Buzzsprouts and to the Darrell McClain Show and subscribe.
I didn't have any second thoughts. I mean, we have seen this rising trend of hatred and targeting of gay kids and trans kids and black people. And then they came for me. And it is disgusting and vile. It is a hateful thing for a mother to say about another mother. I am the mom to a one-year-old, and we have to push back against hateful garbage.
You know, what's so interesting, Senator, is that people, as you brought up in your speech yesterday, Republicans always try to make every opponent the other. You're the other. Oh, you must be a this or that. And you so effectively in the speech said that I'm a white, Christian, suburban mom who just happens to believe in compassion, who just happens to believe in all the things that you said you believe. And it's so funny that when I have people coming up to me because I oppose Donald Trump, they'll go, oh, I liked you when you used to be conservative. I said, oh, wait, you mean when I supported NATO, when I supported balanced budgets, when I supported gun rights, when I supported, and I just go down the long list. And what's so extraordinary is not only are they performative in their ideology, that it's all about stupid tribalism, they're performative in their Christianity. Some of the most hateful things I've gotten, and I would love for you to talk about this, I will read a tweet that will just be like one of the most, I go, oh my God, what poor soul wrote this? And then you'll read their bio and be like, Christian, living for the Lord for 47 years. And you're like, well, I'm not so sure that's the Jesus I read about in the Gospels. But you see it every day, don't you?
I do. So I flipped a district when I ran for the first time in 2018. So I represent what was a Republican district. I'm a Democrat. And it is this exact tone that the people I represent, Mitt Romney's hometown, want balanced budgets and want the government to work and want us to attract and support businesses and don't want to hate people because they are different. And there was an opportunity for the Republican Party to go back to debating, you know, how we spend tax dollars, but instead it is full fringe QAnon, hateful, hateful rhetoric with no actual policy. So, you know, I see it every day. But part of the reason that I really wanted to identify myself is because this moment is going to require straight, white, Christian, suburban moms to stand up and get uncomfortable and say, this is not okay. Because odds are, you know, a lot of us are probably pretty comfortable and okay. But that doesn't mean that this is okay and we can't stand back and let it happen.
That was a very powerful sentiment right there. A lot of us are probably okay, but it is not okay for us to stand back and say nothing. And she hit the nail on the head about something that I say so much, it might as well be a broken record. When I say they do not want to talk about public policy issues, they want to distract you with culture war. They don't want to talk about the dilapidated roads and bridges and why we are paying high tolls in some places, but the roads are awful. They don't want to talk about what type of funding or the defunding of public school institutions. So they want to talk about, in theory, what a child may learn or may not be learning in a history class, vis-a-vis CRT, that they have not identified any meaningful results of this being taught in K through 12 in a meaningful, large way. They don't want to talk about the water that comes out sometimes yellow and you have to ask what is in the water supply. They don't want to talk about the poverty-like wages that are strangling so many Americans that over 70% of Americans do not have $400 in their savings account. They don't want to talk about the fact that incomes have been stagnant, but inflation has made the prices for everything across the board more expensive. You have to pay more for the same goods or sometimes less or substandard goods than you used to get just last year. They don't want to talk about the fact that the landlords keep raising the rent without doing any meaningful updates or repairs to the homes that they live in. They don't want to talk about the millionaire class and billionaire class now buying up all the real estate so that they can be your landlord in perpetuity. They don't want to talk about why 60 cents of every dollar in the United States goes to the military-industrial complex. So the best thing they can do, the best thing that they can do, is keep you focused on weapons of mass distraction, which is what is that person doing over there that may not fit into your values, that actually has no overall effect on your life.
Now, I'm curious. If something like this had happened when I was in Congress, I would have had Democrats, if a Democrat had attacked me, Democrats would have walked across the aisle and put their arm around me and said, Joe, listen, there's no place for that in Congress, and we're so sorry. I mean, when I got attacked personally, or when other people got attacked, that would happen. I'm curious, did any Republicans come up to you yesterday and say, hey, listen, we're really sorry that one of our own accused you of being a groomer, accused you of pedophilia?
No. And this is the Michigan Republican Party right now. This is the National Republican Party right now.
Where that's disgusting.
It is disgusting. It's hateful. It's horrible.
Yeah. Willie is with us. Willie, you have a question?
Senator, good morning. It's Willie Geist. I mean, we should point out, too, this is not happening in isolation. We saw this at the confirmation hearings for a historic Supreme Court justice where anyone who voted for her was put in that group you were put in with groomers because they thought she'd been too light. And this was fanned by prominent United States senators that she'd been too light in sentencing for child pornography and things like that. But I'm curious about the senator who made this accusation. And it's ugly, but I mean, we have to say it out loud about what she said about you, that you were upset that kindergartners couldn't be sexualized and that you were a groomer effectively. When you looked directly at Senator Tice yesterday and said what you said, did she look back at you? Because everyone's very tough online on Twitter and fundraising emails. What did she do back? What did she say back?
She said nothing back and couldn't even be bothered to look me in the eye. I looked at the back of her head the entire speech. She turned away from me. And, you know, in part of that fundraising email, she accused me of being an online social media troll. And yeah. I have never been one to shy away from saying things to people's face, and she's too much of a coward to even acknowledge my existence.
So what in your estimation, Senator, has happened? Because Michigan, as you say, you know, Mitt Romney, moderate Republicans, balanced budget, things like that. You know, there were movements within the legislature there to try to overturn the election in your state, unsuccessful, thank goodness, for the country. What has changed in the last few years?
It is this rising extremism, and we've seen this play out with gerrymandering. You know, the fact is Michigan is a very purple state. We vote pretty evenly, Democratic versus Republican, but the legislature, particularly the state Senate, has been Republican controlled since 1984, despite the fact that in 2014, they only got less than 50% of the votes. They got 72% of the Senate seats. And it encourages going further and further to the fringes. And we had, you know, an attempted kidnapping of the governor. And we just saw how that trial played out. But the day that we learned in the Senate about that plot, the Senate majority leader walked out of our Senate chambers, walked to the front of our Capitol, and rallied with the same hateful conspiracy theorists that plotted that kidnapping, that came to our chambers fully armed and threatened us and told them to keep going. That's where we're at right now. And unless we all push back and vote them out of office, it's not going to get any better.
So you've certainly got our attention. How has the response been to your speech on the floor?
I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. This was definitely not something that I wanted to do to go viral. But if the message is that hate won't win, I think we're proving that. And we have to say it loudly and clearly and stand up for those who are being attacked, because one day it might be us. And I know that everything that I felt the day that Lana Tice accused me of being a groomer and sexualizing children is that much worse for a trans kid who is getting attacked every single day, who just wants to go to school and have friends and get through the day. And the response has been overwhelming. And my hope is that other white women like me who are doing okay are the ones to stand up and put an end to this, because it won't unless we do it.
I'll just say this. We all meet the people who seem like they are preachy and annoying, and we have a sort of a caricature of them, and some of them are ridiculous. But I will say this as well. If there is systemic oppression or systemic disadvantages in the system, then the people who have to work hard to change the systems are sometimes the most important, the people who have benefited from the structures that have been in place. So I thought this particular video was very powerful, because this particular person was not someone who is of themselves in a marginalized group, but in a group where they say they have certain privileges. And they are trying to use those said privileges to fight for, or speak out for, marginalized groups. This thing is a ploy. it has been a ploy. It is a bait and switch where you can talk about fake things versus real things. And that is not just happening in Michigan. It's happening in my home state of Florida as well. Let's go to Breaking Points. Now, this is going to be a clip. It was from this week from 425 from Crystal Ball. And she's going to be talking about a fight between the governor, Ron DeSantis, who does have presidential aspirations. Ron DeSantis wants to be the president of the United States, and he has figured out in his march towards being the president of the United States, the best thing you can do is jump headlong in the culture war and make much ado about nothing.
Well, guys, there's a big political fight down in Florida pitting conservatives spearheaded by Governor Ron DeSantis against liberals and the Walt Disney Corporation. Honestly, it is the sort of brain-rotting culture war mess that we typically stay away from here. But it is worth digging into because I actually think it kind of says everything about the sorry, principle-free, reactionary, pointless nature of a lot of our politics. It's a fake fight with fake stakes simultaneously about everything and nothing at all. And it has scrambled brains across the political spectrum. This fight has got free market bro Ben Shapiro simping for big government.
I am the most free market person on the right. I'm an extraordinarily pro-free market person. I don't believe that generally the government should crack down on the operations of businesses. I think more freedom for businesses are good. I think that lower taxes for business are good for the economy of Florida, for the company, for the economy of the United States more broadly. However, corporations have to stand up for their own free market bona fides. And they have to not become tools of the people who wish to destroy freedom in this country on behalf of leftist groupthink. If you decide to just become a woke corporation that does the bidding of your Democratic taskmasters, don't be surprised when you get clocked with a legislative 2x4. F around and find out.
So basically, yay corporate power, unless corporations happen to do something I don't personally like, in which case, yay government power. Sounds like a really solid and principled ideology you got there. It's also got liberals who have railed against the notion that corporations should be given civil rights, suddenly sounding like Mitt Romney declaring that corporations are people too, my friend. Here's The Intercept exploring whether Disney's First Amendment rights to free speech have been violated. Here's TNR gloating about how progressive tolerance is now a profitable posture embraced by companies as a market strategy. They're right in that assessment, by the way. But they never quite get around in the piece to saying that even when the free market happens to line up with liberal ideology, corporate personhood and control over government still really bad. Okay, so let me give you the outlines of what is happening here. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis obviously wants to run for president, and his strategy to endear himself with the conservative base is to pass a whole bunch of culture war legislation intended first and foremost to own the libs. In response to Black Lives Matter protests, he passed laws restricting the right to protest, which got rather awkward when protests against the Cuban government broke out, violating the new laws that DeSantis had just passed. After restricting speech with those anti-protest laws, he then supposedly took a stand for free speech by passing tech legislation, the impact of which likely negligible, but send all the right signals that he is against censorship, at least when it's applied to ideas that he happens to support. Proving how limited his commitment to free speech is ultimately, though, he then passed an extremely broad law in line with the latest conservative moral panic over critical race theory. That law has led to dozens of math textbooks being banned for controversial ideas like encouraging kids to disagree respectfully. Apparently, not wanting kids to be jerks is now part of woke ideology. But the latest culture war brushfire is over a law that has been dubbed the Don't Say Gay Law by its critics. The portion of the law which has gotten the most attention bans teaching of sexuality and gender in grades K-3. For older grades, such learning must be, quote, age appropriate. Of course, sex ed is already banned through fifth grade in Florida, so this seems basically to be nothing more than meaningless culture war posturing once again.
Very important point that I pointed out to a friend this week that a lot of people didn't know. The teaching of sex education is already banned. It's been banned for several years from K through, I want to say, fifth grade. And so, like I said, when you get some of these policies where it's like, this is all ado about nothing, there's another example of that.
On the other hand, the law does open up avenues for parents to sue school districts if they feel that the law is being violated. Because the language of the law is extremely vague, this has sparked fears that activist parents backed by conservative legal infrastructure could target school districts for infractions as trivial as potentially a child mentioning their same-sex parents in a classroom discussion, or perhaps a teacher having a picture of their same-sex partner on their desk. Now, I honestly don't know if that's realistic fear or not, but nobody else does either. But what is absolutely clear here is that the main intent of the law is to serve as an anti-gay virtue signal bill, framed as a parental control bill, passed for one reason alone, and that's to further Ron DeSantis' political ambitions. DeSantis can signal that he's tough on gay and trans people to his base while painting it in inoffensive terms of parental control to the majority, its vagueness allowing him to portray it however he wants, depending on the audience. Now, the language is so mushy as to both be meaningless and all-encompassing. And as such, it is absolutely fair for gay and trans people to feel attacked by the law, because it seems increasingly clear that the GOP hasn't so much embraced gay people as full human beings as beat a temporary culture war retreat, given that support for gay marriage and basic rights for gay people has gained overwhelming mainstream acceptance. So instead of being upfront about their desire to roll back gains like Obergefell, they're reaching for coded language about sexual deviance and about grooming, attempting to return to a prior generation's framing of non-hetero people as perverts and pedophiles. The Libs of TikTok account, this is kind of their stock and trade, showing some random teacher talking about their pronouns and then accuse them of grooming children. It's a clever sleight of hand, frankly. You're not opposing gay rights or trans rights per se. Instead, you're opposing things everyone hates, things like pedophilia and targeting of vulnerable children. Of course, if Republican Party elites really hated such things, then they probably wouldn't have been cool with Roy Moore as their nominee in Alabama. With conservatives firmly in control of the Supreme Court and positioned to hold a trifecta of federal government control come 2024, it is absolutely reasonable to see this as a trial balloon for further attacks on previously established rights. All right, so that's the law. In response to that law, Disney, Florida's most iconic business, denounced the law and, crucially, paused all political contributions to Florida politicians who are typically showered with Mickey Mouse cash. Now, that move came after Disney's own employees protested and staged a walkout over Disney's initial lack of response to the bill. Let me pause for a moment and just remind everybody, especially my friends on the left, that Disney is actually bad. If you are on the left, Walt Disney Corporation is not and will never be an ally in any fight. Their products have been made in inhumane sweatshops. Take a look at this. Their American workers have been routinely used and abused. A 2018 report found that 11% were paid so poorly they were actually homeless. Two-thirds were food insecure, and a majority worried about facing eviction. Disney is taking this stance in this fight because they think it's going to help their bottom line, aligning them with the values of the affluent PMC. It's that simple. It's a vague gesture towards progressive principles intended to bolster market position with the tolerant majority. In response, DeSantis and the Republicans decided they were going to do something to show how tough they were about standing up to Disney's fake progressivism. So they passed a bill revoking Disney's special tax district, something called Reedy Creek. Now, this sounds like it's bad and like it's going to really hurt Disney, but the reality is actually quite different. A local reporter dug deeply into the likely consequences, and basically, the primary benefit Disney gains from the Reedy Creek district is the ability to govern themselves. This makes it easier for them to launch new infrastructure projects and build new hotels and the like, but it actually comes with a higher tax bill for Disney. They tax themselves to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars and use it to then pay for essential services, things like police and fire and sewer. Essentially, Disney has accepted higher taxes for the ability to flexibly self-govern. Without the special tax district, that tax burden that was previously shouldered by Disney is now instead going to be passed to local county residents, not to mention responsibility for the debts that Reedy Creek has accrued. So, the likely overall impact of ending the Reedy Creek special tax district is to cut Disney's taxes and to raise taxes on ordinary Floridians. In other words, the GOP's attack on Disney is fake. It won't really hurt Disney, but it feels like it'll hurt Disney. And in the culture war, the show, that's all that ultimately matters. So let me just try to sum up here this brain-melting series of events. You got a fake ally in Disney making a fake stand over a likely meaningless law with fake consequences devised by a culture warrior who is really just using this whole fake fight to fuel his own political ambitions. Meanwhile, the plutocrat class can just look on and laugh as the heated battlegrounds of politics are increasingly focused on these theatrical displays of divisive cultural signaling instead of a material politics that could actually rebalance the scales and provide basic dignity to American families. In the macro, nothing is better for Disney and Apple and Google and all the rest than the public being consumed by these culture war brush fires while the status quo of poverty and despair and plutocracy continues unabated. If the GOP or anyone else is really interested in humbling the Disney executives, they use the power of the government to make it easier for Disney's long mistreated employees to unionize and have a say in the day-to-day running of their workplace. That's why, without a doubt, the most important political fight in the country is the one that's being fought that we just talked about by workers at Starbucks and Amazon and elsewhere. It's the correct battle with the correct divide. And it's not going to confuse people into thinking that Ben Shapiro is against corporate power or Disney is a progressive ally or that we should fight to defend the sanctity of corporate civil rights.
So I would say that I think Crystal nails it perfectly on the head with that monologue. I will just add to that what ends up happening in this case. This particular situation is virtue signaling actually hurt the citizens of the actual state. The people's taxes in that particular district are now going to go up because the governor wanted to play this political game with a corporation. So we'll see how this goes. I'm always very interested when I have to listen to these arguments about private institutions and a private institutions, should they be independent from the state and able to make their own decisions, and how said private institutions are at the same time held under scrutiny by the same people. And I think about this when I think about Disney and the way conservatives want Disney to be held to conservative standards. And because Disney as a private institution makes decisions that conservatives don't like, they want to punish Disney. And in the same way, Twitter as a private institution makes private decisions about speech regulations on their platform, and conservatives step into private institutions and say, this should not be done this way. The government should do something about this. And because the government's not going to do something about this, we will celebrate a private entity, a person as such as Elon Musk, paying money for this private institution, Twitter. And I think when I looked, Twitter was worth about $34 a share. And Elon Musk paid about $54 a share, which at a point to where the offer is so good that Twitter, just by fiduciary responsibilities to their board of directors, cannot turn down a deal that great. I think that the buyout was somewhere from, I think it was like $45 billion, but it was a remarkably ridiculous amount of money. And I juxtaposed that when I thought about it, I was like, what is this fundamentally about? That decision to me, and I don't want to get too deep into it, but I thought it was ridiculous only because it was all about speech. And I have episodes about freedom of speech, and obviously I am a free speech absolutist, but at the same time I thought about the remarkable waste to want to spend money on something for the spreading of speech that is not actually it really hasn't been taken. So I don't think that there is anybody that can say, and I want us to think about this in our own experiences on both sides of the fence. Are there any people on the left who think that people on the right don't have enough speech, that you just can't find them speaking at all times, at all places, if you seek that out. Is there any shortage of right-wing ideology that we can all find? Are there not right-wing news stations that we all can seek out? Do we not know who right-wing commentators are? Is anybody stopping Ben Shapiro from speaking? Is anybody stopping Candace Owens from speaking? Is anybody stopping Tucker Carlson from speaking? No, that is not happening. Laura Ingraham has been on television and on AM radio since I was knee-high from a grasshopper. She's still speaking. Still saying the same old stuff, but still speaking. Megan Fox, Megan Fox. Megan Kelly is still out there, has changed networks because she claimed to be sexually harassed by Roger Ailes. You know, family values Roger Ailes. And still speaking. On the other side of that coin, is there any radical leftist in their ideology that is not allowed to speak? I mean, they may not be speaking on Fox News, but they're speaking on MSNBC. They're speaking on Democracy Now. They're speaking on the Real Truth Network, or the Real News Network. They were, and this was incorrect, they used to be speaking on Russia Today, and YouTube took down the entire catalogs of several people like the great Chris Hedges. Said he was a Russian asset, which was absolutely ridiculous. The guy used to write amazing things for the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winner, amazing work overseas. And it's like, tech corporations censor people, period, who don't fit the model for big corporate power messaging. They don't really care if you're on the left or if you're on the right. It is all about what the advertisers are saying that they want to have promoted on the channel. And if the advertisers are not saying, especially like on places like YouTube, like, yeah, this doesn't fit the algorithm, this doesn't fit our model, you are not going to be monetized. They're not going to suggest your videos, which is, in my humble opinion, is a way of censoring. So now what? We have to wait for a benevolent billionaire to buy YouTube in order to cut out the algorithm automatically saying, oh, you watch this video about, you know, this independent media source, you would definitely love insert corporate media structure that has paid them to suggest that you suggest them. You know, so Disney will be fine being Disney. Disney, if you really look at all the Disney movies, take just one Saturday and Sunday, just sit back down and look at the old Disney movies and see what you saw. Disney has always been preachy. It's not going to stop being preachy. Disney has always tried to push an agenda. You can say it is a humanitarian or utilitarian globalist agenda. I always think about the obvious, which would be Pocahontas. Think about when you watch that Pocahontas movie and just remember the little song that Pocahontas sang when she encountered John Smith. And she said, you think you own every land you land on. The world is just a dead thing you can claim, but I know every life, sea, and creature has a life, has a spirit, has a name. You think the only people who are people are those who live and think the way you do. But if you look into the eyes of a stranger, you'll find things you never knew you never knew. Now, I haven't heard that in years, but I watched the movie as a kid and I still know the song. You know what I mean? If you were raised on that, you are nominally going to be somewhere in the middle or to the left. You're going to be very anti-imperialist in your thinking. You may even become, you know, a vegan. Because even though the movie was about the story of Pocahontas, and it was a cartoon, it was obviously giving you an anti-imperial message. That we don't run the world message. Because we say so is not a good message. So Disney's going to be fine. Florida will be fine. The people that will be punished temporarily are the people who are going to have the higher taxes in a state that has been known for, and people flock to it because they don't have state taxes. They don't, you see, go to a store, something says it's 99 cents, you pay 99 cents. Ron DeSantis, in order to punish Disney, has raised the taxes of his constituents. And we will see if they punish him for that. Or he may not be punished because he may go off and run for governor. I mean, he may go off and run for president. And he may actually, if he gets the nomination, somebody like Ron DeSantis would more than likely win the presidency. Now, I have seen interesting polling that does show that, surprisingly, in a presidential runoff, Joe Biden beats Ron DeSantis by 8 points. And Joe Biden's polling numbers right now are in the dirt. But it still shows he beats Ron DeSantis by 8 points. And it shows Joe Biden still beats Donald Trump by 4 points. So, speaking of anti-imperialism, Professor Noam Chomsky, who's always been an anti-war type of figure, an anti-imperialist figure, an anti-U.S. military-industrial complex figure, as well as, because he happens to also be Jewish, an anti-Israel occupation figure, has gotten to a bit of a dust-up because he said that there's only one realistic path for Ukraine. And he's saying that in order for it to happen, Ukraine is going to have to pretty much surrender to Russia if there's going to be any peace. He a very lengthy interview in Current Affairs, which I am a patron of Current Affairs, 54 minutes. If you want to listen to the entire 54 minutes, go pay $5 a month. You get all the full content, very good stuff going on over there. Look, if you just want to hear the one interview, pay the $5 and then cancel the subscription, whatever. But I'm going to let you hear a bit, Professor Noam Chomsky, vis-a-vis them talking about what he said on Rising. And we'll get to whether Noam Chomsky is correct on Ukraine on the other side.
Well, famed leftist icon Noam Chomsky started trending on social media after he upset liberals for saying Ukraine should negotiate with Russia rather than fight in a bloody war. Noam first sat down with Nathan J. Robinson from Current Affairs, where he said, quote, "In this world, there are two options with regard to Ukraine. As we know, one option is a negotiated settlement, which will offer Putin an escape, an ugly settlement. Is it within reach? We don't know. You can only find out by trying, and we're refusing to try, but that's one option. The other option is to make it explicit and clear to Putin and the small circle of men around him that you have no escape. You're going to go to war crimes trial no matter what you do. Boris Johnson just reiterated this. Sanctions will go on no matter what you do. What does that mean? It means go ahead and obliterate Ukraine and go on to lay the basis for a terminal war. Those are the two options. And we're picking the second and praising ourselves for heroism and doing it, fighting Russia to the last Ukrainian." He reiterated these sentiments while talking with Jeremy Scahill from The Intercept.
"The right question is, what is the best thing to do to save Ukraine from a grim fate, from further destruction? And that's to move towards a negotiated settlement. There are some simple facts that aren't really controversial. There are two ways for a war to end. One way is for one side or the other to be basically destroyed. And the Russians are not going to be destroyed. So that means one way is for Ukraine to be destroyed. The other way is some negotiated settlement. If there's a third way, no one's ever figured it out. So what we should be doing is devoting all the things you mentioned, if properly shaped, but primarily moving towards possible negotiated settlement that will save Ukrainians from further disaster."
Now, in both interviews, he quotes respected veteran diplomat and former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense Chaz Freeman, who said the U.S.'s policy is not to negotiate, but to fight to the last Ukrainian. Chomsky said in his interview with Current Affairs, I don't know if you saw it, but a couple of days ago, there was a very important interview by one of the most astute and respected figures in current U.S. diplomatic circles, Ambassador Chaz Freeman. A very important interview. He pointed out that the current U.S. policy, which he bitterly criticized, is to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. And he gave us an example, President Biden's heroic statement about the war criminal Putin, Biden's counterpart, as a war criminal. And Freeman pointed out the obvious. The U.S. is setting things up so as to destroy Ukraine and lead to a terminal war. Well, the very important interview Noam Chomsky is referring to is one in which Chaz Freeman sat down with Aaron Maté from the Gray Zone back in late March.
But we don't know where this is going. And more to the point, the United States is not part of any effort to negotiate an end to the fighting. To the extent that there is mediation going on, it seems to be by Turkey, possibly Israel, maybe China. And that's about it. The United States is not in the room. Everything we are doing, rather than accelerating an end to the fighting and some compromise, seems to be aimed at prolonging the fighting, assisting the Ukrainian resistance, which is a noble cause, I suppose, but that will result in a lot of dead Ukrainians as well as dead Russians. Zelensky is obviously a very intelligent man, and he saw what the consequences of being put in what he called limbo would be. Namely, Ukraine would be hung out to dry. And the West was basically saying, we will fight to the last Ukrainian for Ukrainian independence, which essentially remains our stand. It's pretty cynical.
Chaz Freeman also talks about something Chomsky is experiencing right now, being labeled a Putin puppet for calling for peace.
I know people who have been attempted to be objective about this, and they're immediately accused of being Russian agents, or that is to say, the price of speaking on this subject is to join the pom-pom girls in a frenzy of support for our position. If you're not part of the chorus, you're not allowed to say anything, and not you can't sing. So I think that this has had very injurious effects on Western liberties. And it has enforced an almost, I won't say it's totalitarian, but it's certainly a similar kind of control on freedom of expression and inquiry in the West. It's very depressing, really.
So, Ryan and Robbie, I mean, there's definitely a problem here, you know, that Chaz Freeman, I think, is bringing up of, you know, if you say anything other than just fight, fight, fight until the last Ukrainian, then you're labeled a Putin puppet. But one thing Noam said in his interviews is there's a difference between being rational and being humane. And he says, you know, you might think it's rational for Ukraine to continue fighting. Like, for example, of course, they have the right to defend themselves. No one is saying they don't have that right. Do they have a right to American and Western weapons and, you know, constant stream of weaponry? That's a discussion to have, but they absolutely have the right to defend themselves. But what is humane for the Ukrainian people? That is a bigger question in this battle. And so, you know, but it's interesting that Noam Chomsky is just getting eviscerated. It just kind of shows me that there's so much about what is traditionally liberal values that seem to have just been, they're just deteriorating. I mean, just free, you know, lack of censorship. Right now, you've got so many liberals championing censorship. You have liberals championing big tech and big pharma. And now even the military industrial complex just saying, yeah, we need more war, more war, more war. So it's like amazing to me, this kind of transformation that's been happening over the years. But, you know, Ryan, what is your take on Noam getting dragged for calling for peace and saying this is the realistic option is you're just going to have to give Russia something, like it or not, if you don't want to destroy Ukraine.
So before you get to Ryan Grimm, and Ryan Grimm does great work, let me go ahead and just say something very concrete and clear from a historical political shift concept. when Donald Trump ran for president and you had these so-called never Trump Republicans, remember who these people were. They were people like David Frum. David Frum was one of the major speechwriters for George H.W. Bush. He is literally one of the people who came up with the term access of evil. And very pro-war person. Supported the Iraq war, supported the Afghanistan war. What it looks like in perpetuity, because he still supports those policies. You have people like Bill Kristol, you know, who is supported and allowed on MSNBC, supposedly the liberal network, who is an anti-Trump Republican who voted for Democrats, who votes for Democrats now because they were more reasonable, air quotes, than the current iteration of the Republican Party. So you have the David Frums now caucusing with the Democratic Party. You have the Bill Kristols, who has never seen a war he didn't like, caucusing with the Democratic Party. You have the Joe Scarboroughs of the world. Joe Scarborough, the former congressman from my home state of Florida, was too crazy for Newt Gingrich. Joe Scarborough, remember, came in on the party of a wave that thought Newt Gingrich wasn't radical enough for Joe Scarborough. Newt Gingrich was appeasing Bill Clinton. And Joe Scarborough now, for years, is a commentator on MSNBC as if he is the reasonable voice of what a sensible Republican look like. But if you go look at the record, when Joe Scarborough was in Congress, he was a nut. And he voted for nutty legislation. But now he is seen, I'm an independent. Cool. He caucuses and votes for Democrats. And you can keep going down that list. Michelle Wallace now has a job. Former George W. Bush advisor, etc. Michelle Wallace, where does she work now? MSNBC, the liberal network. She is an anti-Trump Republican, air quotes. I now vote with the Democrats, which means I champion those wars. I still believe in that. I am still going to vote for that. So the anti-war voices in the Democratic Party are going to be shouted down point blank, period. And there's also a bit of a bait and switch going on here where we have to pretend like Democrats have always, been anti-war. But we have to remember there was a single Democrat by the name of Barbara Lee who opposed the war in the Middle East. There was the single vote of Barbara Lee, and every other Democrat voted to go to war. So this whole thing about, and the Noam Chomsky is being blasted by liberals for his anti-war stance and just exposes the new pro-war left. No. The left has always been just as pro-war as the right. They have positioned themselves to look as if they are anti-war when it is convenient. Remember, even if you look at it from just a look at what you saw on television, before you got Chris Mathis and Lawrence O'Donnell and even Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, you had a gentleman by the name of Phil Donahue. Phil Donahue started with his chest out, back straight forward, both arms blasting the wars in the Middle East. And MSNBC, there was a leaked memo that said they had to get rid of Phil Donahue because they did not want MSNBC's head correspondents to be seen as anti-war. So the liberal station, MSNBC, got rid of Phil Donahue, and they replaced Phil Donahue with Chris Mathis, who was kind of this, what are you going to say? You know, George Bush, blah, 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 Tip O'Neill, you know, and that was his MO. And we all saw he fell on the Me Too sword. And now, when Chris Matthews ended his stint in MSNBC, he's blasting. He ends that blasting Bernie Sanders because Bernie Sanders is trying to end the long since President John F. Kennedy sanctions against Cuba. Chris Matthews, the liberal, is blasting Bernie Sanders because he thinks that you should try to normalize relations with Cuba and Fidel Castro. And he's blasting him because during the time where it was difficult to be peaceful, Bernie Sanders visited Cuba. He says, oh my goodness, Bernie Sanders went over there and talked to the enemy. Well, I'm sorry. I got to break the news for you. Breaking news here on the Darrell McClain Show. In order to have peace, you have to talk to your enemies. You can't just talk to people who are already peaceful. They already get it. You actually have to talk to people you disagree with. So let's hear what Ryan Grimm has to say about this.
Right, it's kind of delusional, and it's actually why I asked Jen Psaki that question in the press room a couple of weeks ago. That said, you know, what is the U.S. doing to push negotiations toward a settlement forward? Well, like, what is the U.S. doing? And her answer was, well, we're the largest provider of weapons and also humanitarian aid. And that does seem to be the U.S. strategy here, that they're going to somehow get to a settlement by, you know, continuing this war and continuing to keep Ukraine in the fight, which I think can make sense in the very beginning. But it's now quickly moving into a almost endless war type of situation and fitting in with a new strategy that the U.S. is developing toward Russia. And the Washington Post reported over the weekend, they said the Biden administration and its European allies have begun planning for a far different world in which they no longer try to coexist and cooperate with Russia, but actively seek to isolate and weaken it as a matter of long-term strategy. And one of the ways to isolate and weaken a country is to keep it in a kind of low-grade war in eastern Ukraine endlessly.
Yeah, I was surprised to see Chomsky getting criticized so hard for those remarks. And I don't necessarily, you know, agree with Chomsky probably as much as you do, Ryan, and maybe you, Kim, I don't know, probably on the foreign policy questions. So I might have criticized him for something he would say about this, but I thought what he said was perfectly in keeping with, you know, kind of the discussion we've all had on the show, along the lines of, you know, what you just outlined. But yes, they have the right to defend themselves. You know, yes, ideally we want them to, you know, we want Russia to desist from this war, but us just wanting that is not going to make it happen. So what can we, you know, what is actually going to make it happen? What is actually going to bring this to a peaceful resolution? Obviously a resolution that not everyone is completely happy with, that I'm not completely happy with as someone who wants, you know, Ukraine to keep all its territory. I want Russia, the authoritarian government of Russia, totally defeated and humiliated, but that's just not, like, realistic. So what is realistic? And we have to be willing to have that conversation, and our government has to be willing to work toward that. And they give some indication that, yeah, like you said, Ryan, they're looking for something more, something longer, something that will leave a lot more Ukrainians dead.
Well, and one thing Noam even said in his interviews is he talked about the Brzezinski plan. Brian, I don't know if you're familiar with this one, but he mentioned that Hillary Clinton actually brought it up just the other day, saying that, you know, praising the fact that the U.S. was able to bait Russia into a war in Afghanistan and then continued the war forever, prolonged it by arming and training the rebels, which we all know, the Mujahideen, which we all know then eventually became, you know, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And so she was actually saying, well, we did it once and this Brzezinski plan was great. And so we're basically championing the idea of doing it again in Ukraine, which is, and then he quoted somebody, I forgot who it was, another official who said, well, it's not about, it isn't about the Afghan lives, for example, when he's talking about Afghanistan. He says this is about hobbling a world power from expanding. So you have to kind of pick and choose which one's more important to you. And he was essentially saying it's more important to us to hobble the Soviets at the time than it is to, then, you know, who cares about Afghan lives? And I think that's exactly what we're seeing here. And by the way, that Chaz Freeman interview was back in mid-March. I think it was like the 22nd or 23rd of March when he said that. And he said, look, the U.S.'s plan is just to continue this war and keep supplying weapons. And we've seen now, 3 weeks later, that's absolutely the case. We've still been doing that. You know, there hasn't been any real true attempt at a negotiation. It has been Turkey. It has been Israel. Has even been China, you know, other countries. And so, you know, Americans, I think, as a public, need to get together and ask, you know, are we really, do we just not care about human life at all? Are we just like, whatever, fight it out, you know, like gladiator style until one of you is dead? And we know which one that's going to be. But I guess it'll, you know, but it'll weaken Russia for the next however many years. I mean, it's just, it's a depressing situation.
If the American policy really was to just prolong this war in order to weaken Russia and to not, and to make it very difficult to reach a settlement, what they're doing now is what they would do. Like they would say, hey, if this war ends, we're going to keep the sanctions on. Would say, hey, when this war is over, you know, you're going to be prosecuted as a war criminal. And keep funneling weapons in the meantime. Like if your strategy was to make sure that the war lasted as long as it possibly could, that's precisely what you would do. So if that's not their strategy, then they're going about it completely wrong. The only explanation to me, given that they're not complete idiots, is that they're getting what they want out of this.
Yeah. So America needs to kind of understand we traded wars now. You know, we traded Afghanistan for Ukraine. The only difference is at this point, which could change, we don't have troops in Ukraine as we did in Afghanistan.
The other difference, key, is that we're risking nuclear annihilation.
And I think that is the key point that Professor Chomsky works hard to point out. So in the show notes, I am going to post what is an hour and 32-minute video with Noam Chomsky and Daniel Ellsberg, titled pretty much what I think the root of it is, which is and it was titled how to avoid nuclear war. So just as, like I said, it's an hour and about 32 minutes. I watched it. It was a great video, and it happened. You know, a lot of things happened this month, including something I'll tell you a bit about. But anyway, so this was on April 24th, and the Bessie editor-in-chief of The Intercept moderated a discussion between Noam Chomsky and Dale Esberg on the topic of nuclear policy and war. Of course, Noam Chomsky, the laureate professor of linguistics, and he is currently still at the University of Arizona. And Ellsberg is the person who blew the papers, the famous Pentagon Papers whistleblower, and the author of The Doomsday Machine and Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, appeared on stage together for the actual very first time. The discussion was held at the University of Arizona College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, and they broadcasted a free live stream of the conversation to viewers around the world. So if you missed it, I did post the entire video where they discuss these things, or Noam Chomsky brings up a lot of these topics. And this is what we have to look at when we look at this situation that's going on in Ukraine. Because this is not just about Ukraine and the position that it happens to be sitting in with the United States of America, right? And this is about Russia and Russia's presence on the global stage, and Russia being a pariah state and not wanting to accept the fact that it was a pariah state. It is different with Assad, you know, for everything that he did in Syria, right? And he did all those things, and Obama drew his red line, and Assad crossed the red line, and you have not heard anything about Assad in a very long time, because he is seen as a pariah. But Assad is not, and Syria is not, a well-known nuclear arsenal carrying power with a massive military force to project its hegemonic views around the world. Russia is a nuclear power. Russia is somebody that used to have a treaty with the United States of America called the Star Treaty. Russia is a global force, whether you think they are for good or for bad. Russia is a global force in the world. Russia does have as many nuclear weapons. Some people have said they have more shoulder-fired nuclear missiles, etc., or short-range nuclear missiles, I think, than the United States. So I think that's what Professor Chomsky is pointing at. You can both walk and chew gums at the same time. You can both say that what the Ukrainian people are doing and fighting somebody who is trying to crush them is commendable, while also recognizing that the fight is futile in this, and that unless the other powers, the other people who have the sphere of influence, the other people who have the absolute weapons and nuclear capabilities and everything else, actually put skin in the game by having boots on the ground, then this is a very entrenched situation. This is going to be a prolonged, long process. This is going to be very painful. Hundreds of thousands of people are going to pass away. And I think it is a bit cynical for us to sit in the United States and say we will sacrifice the Ukrainians unto the last man if it will destabilize Russia. That is a very, very Machiavellian way to view the world. And the people that are hurt the most by this in the end will be not the Russians, but I think it'll be the Ukrainians. So I think that Professor Chomsky tries in his, you know, Noam Chomsky's an old man at this point. He is 93 years old. If he lives to see this December, you know, obviously we do the work, do the math, he'll be 94. He was born in 1928. So what he's trying to do is say, look, peace is complicated. You have to make concessions with your enemies. You have to be strategic. And so that is there's no way to get around that. A war with China and Russia at the same time means a goodbye, more than likely, to civilization. And there's a propaganda war going on at the same time. And we have to recognize when we see that. Now, that being said, I have also put in the show notes the entire interview with Noam Chomsky and Jeremy Scahill on the Russian and Ukraine war and the media propaganda and accountability, where he goes through, you know, obviously in long form, all those things. And I think he provides a sobering response to how we have to view this type of conflict. I mean, just this week, Biden has asked Congress for an additional $33 billion for Ukrainian funding. And that has to have a response. I always think about the song from the late rapper Tupac Shakur. You know, you got guns for money for war, but not to feed the poor. And $33 billion is nothing to sneeze at. I want us to think about when it comes to these types of conflicts, right? That what we support and what we don't support. So let me just end with this, because I brought it up. So the President Biden asked Congress to approve the $33 billion to continue providing military, economic, and humanitarian assistance to Ukraine. And an additional security, economic, humanitarian assistance to Ukraine and help the country fend off the prolonged Russian attack over the next 5 months. The massive $33 billion request is what Biden administration says is necessary to help Ukraine's military to defeat a sustained attack over the coming months and address the global impact of the war. Officials believe the funding will last through the current fiscal year, which ends in September. Now, breaking down the numbers, the White House says it needs Congress to approve about $20 billion in security assistance for Ukraine, including $5 billion for weapons and other military aid, $6 billion for the Ukrainian Security Assistance Initiative, and $4 billion for the State Department Foreign Military Financing Program. And administration officials told reporters on a call previewing the request. Now, additional, Biden is asking Congress to approve $8.5 billion more in economic assistance for Ukraine and $3 billion in humanitarian assistance and food security funding, the official said. Now, with all of those numbers, and I can 100% say that the Ukrainian people deserve to be respected and protected. I'm just going to ask you to think about, juxtapose that with how every single time in this country that we happen to live in, we ask that you support working and struggling people in this country. Now, there seems to be no money. In the words of the late Tony Benn, the British parliamentarian, a member of parliament, if you can have money to kill people, you can have money to help people. So I started off the show with the quote of the day from Dr. Cornel West. If you can, justice is what love looks like in public. Just as tenderness is what love looks like in private, right? So let me go ahead on and treat us to, in the blast from the intellectual past section, how I'm going to end the show, is a snippet of Dr. Cornel West.
And I think one of the saddest features of our day is American culture is more and more beginning to look like a Hamlet-like condition. Now, Hamlet, as you know, is the most sophisticated philosophical protagonist in all of modern literature, written by the greatest bard in the English that most, the language that many of us dream in, Shakespeare. No, we've got some Spanish brothers and sisters, so I don't want to be culturally imperialist about this. If you dreaming in the language of Cervantes, that's a beautiful thing. That's beautiful too. Oh yeah. The language of Goethe in German or whatever. But the important thing is Hamlet suffers from the inability to love. And Dostoevsky and the Brothers Karamazov says hell is defined by those who suffer from the inability to love. Well, American culture more and more becomes a joyless quest for pleasure, insatiable pleasure, never get enough of it, endless, bottomless, and the inability to really be committed to love. Because love is a form of death. And you have to learn how to die in order to learn how to love. That's why the New Testament says what Christians must die daily. Die daily. What a culture's joyless quest for pleasure is a denial of death. That's why we can easily deny those locked into social death. We can deny those locked into civic death. Those wrestling with psychic death. Spiritual death. We were talking before about wrestling with the issue of mental illness. And you and Kay have been magnificent in your courage. And I've been praying. Magnificent in your courage. But the ways in which it's so easy to lose sight of the precious humanity of those wrestling with the mental illness. I mean, I've been to jail so many times, and at least one out of three of the brothers and sisters in my cell are wrestling with mental illness. And unable to get medication. And they tend to stand there longer than me, and I stand there long enough. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to get out. But in talking about disagreement, we're not just talking about something political. We're not just talking about even something civil. We're talking about something just talking about even something civil. We're talking about something spiritual. Something profoundly spiritual. And for Christians, it is inescapably spiritual. And in the end, of course, it's an acknowledgement of having a hermeneutical humility and an intellectual humility, acknowledging that you could be wrong, and there's a good chance that you are at times wrong. But you're still willing to stand in your truth and try to speak your truth and opt for a deep integrity rather than a cheap popularity. Because so oftentimes in America, to be popular is to be well adjusted to injustice. See, that's not the kind of popularity Christians ought to be interested in. To be popular, being well adapted to indifference, that's not the kind of popularity Christians ought to be interested in. The benchmark of the Christian way of life, of the way of the cross, is there goes some of those strange folk who look like they're fools in the eyes of the world, who are still trying to love against the grain, knowing that justice is what love looks like in public, just like tenderness is what love feels like in private. And you say, oh, those are those strange ones. That's where it was in the early church, wasn't it? Those are those strange ones still talking about love, obsessed with that Palestinian Jew named Jesus who was enacting, embodying that love. You say, yes. That's right, you got it right. That's right, you got it right. That's what we're about. So in that sense, I do want to begin on that pietistic note and a spiritual note. Because I'll end, I think Reinhold Niebuhr put it so well. He said, any justice that's only justice soon degenerates into something less than justice.
Good point.
Yeah. Justice must be rescued by something much more deeper than justice, which is love. Love of truth, love of neighbor, and for me, love of enemy. We won't go into that now, but I think that's very, very important. Because it means then even your foe is part of the human family. And in some ways, an extension of your own humanity. Because for most of us, I know in my case, that I was a gangster before I met Jesus, and now I'm a redeemed sinner with gangster proclivities.
Yeah, that's it.
So I think that was a beautiful sentiment. And if you want to look at that discussion, that blast from the past came all the way back from 2015. It was a conversation called The Cost of Freedom and How Disagreement Makes Us Civil. And the conversation was with Robert George, Cornel West, and Pastor Rick Warren. Thank you for tuning in to the Darrell McLean Show, and I will see you on the next episode. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Of course, if you want to support the show, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com and getting a membership for as little as $3 a month. Again, that's www.patreon.com/The Darrell McLean Show. The Darrell McLean Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. Get a membership and support independent media at www.patreon.com/The Darrell McLean Show.